The white skin opened in a thin, bright scarlet line from one side of his ribs to the other, and one of the angry purple carbuncles between his shoulder blades erupted in a spurt of yellow matter that ran down the pale skin and soaked into the waistband of his breeches. "One," said Mungo St. John. And the man on the grating began to sob quietly. Tipu stepped back, shook out the lash carefully, squinted at the bloody line across the white, shuddering flesh, reared back and grunted as he stepped forward into the next stroke. "Two," said Mungo St. John. Robin felt her gorge rise to choke her. She fought it down and forced herself to watch. She could not allow him to see her weakness. On the tenth stroke, the body on the grating relaxed suddenly. The head lolled sideways, and the fists unclenched slowly, so that she could see the little bloody half-moon wounds where the nails had been driven into the palms. There was no further sign of life during the rest of the leisurely ritual of punishment. At the 20th stroke, she almost flung herself down the ladder to the main deck and was feeling for the pulse before they could cut the body down from the grating. "Praise be to God," she whispered, as she felt it fluttering under her fingers, and then to the seamen who were lifting the man down. "Gently now." She saw that Mungo St. John had got his wish, for the white porcelain crests of the spinal column were jutting up through the sliced meat of the back muscles. She had a cotton dressing ready, and she placed it across the ruined back as they laid him onto an oak plank and hustled him towards the forecastle. In the narrow, crowded forecastle, thick with the fumes of cheap pipe tobacco and the almost solid reek of bilges and wet clothing, of unwashed men and mouldering food, they laid the man on the mess table, and she worked as best she could in the guttering light of the oil lamp in its gimbals overhead. She stitched back the flaps and ribbons of mushy, torn flesh with horsehair sutures, and then bound up the whole in weak phenol solution, treatment which Joseph Lister had recently pioneered with much success against mortification. The man was conscious again and whimpering with pain. She gave him 5 drops of laudanum and promised to visit him the following day to change the bindings. As she packed away her instruments and closed her black valise, one of the crew, a little pockmarked bosun named Nathaniel, picked it up, and when she nodded her thanks, he muttered with embarrassment, "We are beholden, missus." It had taken all of them time to accept her ministrations. First, it had been only the lancing of carbuncles and sea boils, calomel for the flux and the gripe, but later, after a dozen successful treatments which included a fractured humerus, an ulcerated and ruptured eardrum, and the banishing of a venereal chancre with mercury, she had become a firm favourite amongst the crew, and her sick call a regular feature of shipboard life. The bosun climbed the companionway behind her, carrying the valise, but before they reached the deck, an idea struck her, and she stooped to him, placing a hand on his shoulder. "Nathaniel," she asked urgently, but in a low voice, "is there a way of entering the ship's hold without lifting the main deck hatches?" The man looked startled, and she shook his shoulder roughly. "Is there?" she demanded. "Aye, ma'am, there is." "Where? How?" "Through the lazaretto, below the officer's saloon. There is a hatchway through the forward bulkhead." "Is it locked?" "Aye, ma'am, it is. And Captain St. John keeps the keys on his belt." "Tell nobody that I asked," she ordered him, and hastened up to the main deck. At the foot of the mainmast, Tipu was washing down the lash in a bucket of seawater that was already tinged pale pink. He looked up at her, still stripping the water off the leather between thick, hairless fingers. And he grinned at Robin as she passed, squatting down on thick brown haunches with his loincloth drawn up into his crotch, swinging his round, bald head on its bull neck to follow her. She found herself panting a little with fear and revulsion, and she swept her skirts aside as she passed him. At the door of her cabin, she took the valise from Nathaniel with a word of thanks, and then slumped down upon her bunk. Her thoughts and her emotions were in uproar, for she had still not recovered from the sudden avalanche of events that that had interrupted the leisurely pattern of the voyage. The boarding by Captain Codrington of the Royal Navy overshadowed even her anger at the flogging or her joy at her first view of Africa in nearly two decades. And now his accusations rankled and disturbed her. After a few minutes' rest, she lifted the lid of her travelling chest that filled most of the clear space in the tiny cabin and had to unpack much of it before she found the pamphlets from the Anti-Slavery Society with which she had been armed in London before departure. She sat down to study them once again, a history of the struggle against the trade up to the present time. As she read, her anger and frustration reawakened at the tale of unenforceable international agreements, all with built-in escape clauses, laws that made it an act of piracy to indulge in the trade north of the equator, but allowed it to flourish unchecked in the southern hemisphere. Treaties and agreements signed by all nations, except those most actively engaged in the trade, Portugal, Brazil, Spain. Other great nations, France, using the trade to goad their traditional enemy, Great Britain, shamelessly exploiting Britain's commitment to its extinction, trading political advantage for vague promises of support. Then there was America. A signatory to the Treaty of Brussels, which Britain had engineered, agreeing to the abolition of the trade, but not to the abolition of the institution of slavery itself. America agreed that the transport of human souls into captivity was tantamount to act of piracy, and that vessels so engaged were liable to seizure under prize and condemnation by courts of admiralty or mixed commission. Agreed also to the equipment clause, that ships equipped for transport of slaves, although not actually with a cargo of slaves on board at the time of seizure, could also be taken as prize. There was America agreeing to all of this, and then denying to the warships of the Royal Navy the right of search. The most America would allow was that British officers could assure themselves of the legality of the claim to American ownership, and if that was proven, they could not search, not even though the stink of slaves rose from her holds to offend the very heavens, or the clank of chains and the half-human cries from her tween decks came near to deafening them, still they could not search. Robin dropped one pamphlet back into her chest and selected another publication from the Society. Item. In the previous year, 1859, estimated 169,000 slaves had been transported from the coasts of Africa to the mines of Brazil and the plantations of Cuba and to those of the southern states of America. Item. The trade in slaves by the Omani Arabs of Zanzibar could not be estimated except by observation of the numbers passing through the markets of that island. Despite the British treaty with the Sultan as early as 1822, the British consul at Zanzibar had counted almost 200,000 slaves landed during the previous 12-month period. The corpses were not landed, nor were the sick and dying, for the Zanzibar customs dues were payable to the Sultan per capita, live or dead. The dead, and those so enfeebled or diseased as to have little hope of survival, were thrown overboard at the edge of the deep water beyond the coral reef. Here a permanent colony of huge man-eating sharks cruised the area by day and by night. Within minutes of the first body, dead or still living, striking the water, the surface around the dhow was torn into a seething white boil by the great fish. The British consul estimated a 40% mortality rate amongst slaves making the short passage from the mainland to the island. Robin dropped that pamphlet, and before picking up the next, she reflected a moment on the sheer multitudes involved in the whole grisly business. 5 million since the turn of the century, she whispered. 5 million souls. No wonder that they call it the greatest crime against humanity in the history of the world. She opened the next pamphlet and skimmed quickly over an examination of the profits that accrued to a successful trader. In the interior of Africa, up near the Lake Country, where few white men had ever reached, Fuller Ballantyne had discovered, her father's name in print gave her a prickle of pride and of melancholy, Fuller had discovered that a prime slave changed hands for a cupful of porcelain beads, two slaves for an obsolete Tower musket, that cost 13 shillings in London, or a brown Bess musket that cost $2 in New York. At the coast, the same slave cost $10, while on the slave market in Brazil, he would sell for $500. But once he was taken north of the equator, the risks to the trader increased, and the price rose dramatically. $1,000 in Cuba, $1,500 in Louisiana. Robin lowered the text and thought swiftly. The English captain had challenged that Huron could carry 2,000 slaves at a time. Landed in America, they would be worth an unbelievable $3 million. An amount which would buy 15 ships like Huron. A single voyage would make a man rich beyond mundane dreams of greed. All risks were acceptable to the traders to win such vast wealth. But had Captain Codrington been justified in his accusations? Robin knew the counter-accusations that were made against the officers of the Royal Navy, that their zeal arose from the promise of prize money rather than a hatred of the trade and a love of humanity, that every sail they raised was considered a slaver, and that they were swift to apply the equipment clause in the widest possible interpretation. Robin was searching for the pamphlet that dealt in detail with this equipment clause, and she found it next on the pile before her. To enable a ship to be seized as a slaver under the clause, she need only satisfy one of the stipulated conditions. She could be taken if her hatches were equipped with open gratings to ventilate her holds, if there were dividing bulkheads in her holds to facilitate the installation of slave decks, if there were spare planks aboard for laying as slave decks, if she carried shackles and bolts, or leg irons and cuffs, if she carried too many water casks for the number of her crew and passengers, if she had disproportionately large numbers of mess tubs, or her rice boilers were too big, or if she carried unreasonable quantities of rice or farina. Even if she carried native matting that might be used as bedding for slaves, she could be seized and run in under a prize crew. These were wide powers given to men who could profit financially by seizure. Was Captain Codrington one of these? Were those pale, fanatical eyes merely a mask for avarice and a desire for personal gain? Robin found herself hoping they were, or at least that in the case of Huron he had been mistaken. But then why had Captain St. John put down his helm and run for it the moment he sighted the British cruiser? Robin was confused and miserable, haunted with guilt. She needed comfort, and she slipped a lace Stuart cap over her head and shoulders before venturing out onto the deck again, for the wind had risen to an icy gale, and Huron was always a tender ship. She heeled heavily as she beat southwards, flinging spray high into the falling night. Zuga was in his cabin, dressed in shirt sleeves and smoking a cigar, as he worked over the lists of the expedition's equipment that would still have to be obtained once they reached Good Hope. He called to her to enter when she knocked, and rose to greet her with a smile. "Sissy, are you well? It was a most unpleasant business, even though unavoidable. I hope it has not unsettled you." "The man will recover," she said, and Zuga changed the subject as he settled her on his bunk, the only other seating in the cabin. "I sometimes think we would have been better off with less money to spend on this expedition. There is always such a temptation to accumulate too much equipment. Papa made the Traverser with only 5 porter loads, while we will need 100 porters at the least, each carrying 80 pounds. Zuga, I must speak to you. This is the first opportunity I have had." An expression of distaste flickered across the strong, harsh features, as though he sensed what she was about to say. But before he could deny her, she blurted out, "Is this ship a slaver, Zuga?" Zuga removed the cigar from his mouth and inspected the tip minutely before he replied. "Sissy, a slaver stinks so you can smell it for 50 leagues downwind, and even after the slaves are removed, there is no amount of lie that will get rid of the smell. Huron does not have the stench of a slaver. This ship is on her first voyage under this ownership," Robin reminded him quietly. "Codrington accused Captain St. John of using his profits from previous voyages to purchase her. She is still clean. Mungo St. John is a gentleman. Zuga's tone had an edge of impatience to it now. I am convinced of that.